outlaw it. But, Chacho...
He stopped and looked at the boys closely.
I know of only one Chacho, and he's in intensive care. You wouldn't be boys from the same orphanage.
We might be, Matt said cautiously.
The nurse lowered his voice.
You'd better be careful. Keepers are nosing around. It seems there was a mutiny at the salt works.
How's Chacho?
Asked Fidelito.
Not so good. Listen, I'll take you there, a private way.
The nurse opened a door to a dimly lit passage that seemed to be used for storage. Matt saw piles of bedding and boxes of equipment as they made their way through.
I used to be an orphan myself, the nurse said. Even now, I wake up in a cold sweat, reciting the 5 principles of good citizenship and the 4 attitudes leading to right mindfulness.
They came out to another deserted hallway.
This is the recovery wing, explained the nurse. Here's where the sisters watch over the long-term patients. Chacho is in the last room on the right. If he's sleeping, don't wake him.
The nurse left them and went back to his duties. Matt heard voices coming from the end of the hall. Fidelito ran ahead.
Chacho!
He yelled. Don't wake him, said Matt. But it hardly mattered how much noise the little boy made because the people in the room were shouting even louder. Matt saw a pair of sisters guarding a bed. Facing them were 2 keepers, and next to them, trussed up like a lumpy package on the floor, was Tonton. Tonton mouthed the word,
run. If you move him, he'll die, cried one of the sisters.
We'll do what we like, Sister Ines, a keeper snarled.
Matt instantly recognized the voice. It was Carlos. And the other man, to go by the cast on his arm, was Jorge.
These boys have tried to commit murder, do you understand?
Said Carlos.
I understand that some of your men suffered an injury to their pride. Sister Ines said. Last I heard, no one ever died of humiliation. But if Chacho's moved, it will be murder. I can't allow it.
Then we'll take him without your permission, said Carlos.
Matt saw Sister Ines go pale, but she didn't back down.
You'll have to go through us, she said.
And us, said Matt. The keepers whirled around.
It's that damned aristocrat, shouted Jorge.
He made a grab for Matt, but having only 1 good arm, he stumbled and fell on top of Tonton. Tonton immediately butted his head into Jorge's side.
Stop! Stop! Cried Sister Ines. This is a convent. You aren't allowed to use violence.
Tell them that!
Shouted Matt, who was trying to kick Carlos's feet out from under him. The keeper had hurled himself into the fight when Jorge went down. Matt hadn't a hope of winning. He was badly weakened by his ordeal, and besides, the man outweighed him by 50 pounds. But Matt had had enough of running and hiding. He wasn't going to let the keepers win easily. They were fat toads that Tam Lin wouldn't have thought twice about blowing up. The blood sang in Matt's ears.
Stop this at once,
came a sharp voice that cut through the red fog that had enveloped Matt's mind. He felt Carlos's hands let go. He felt himself falling to his knees. He heard Fidelito sobbing.
This is a disgrace, said the sharp voice.
Matt looked up. It would have been funny if the situation hadn't been so dire. Sister Ines was frozen with her hands grasping Carlos's hair. The other sister had the neck of Jorge's shirt bunched up in her fists, and Jorge was in mid-kick toward Tonton's stomach. Fidelito had thrown himself across Chacho, as though his skinny body could provide protection. And poor Chacho merely stared, as though he'd seen a dragon appear in the doorway. Matt saw a small, but extremely fierce-looking woman with her hands on her hips. She wore a black dress, and her black hair was braided and pinned on top of her head in a kind of crown. She was little, but everything about her proclaimed that she was used to being obeyed, and anyone who didn't was going to regret it.
Doña Esperanza,
stammered Sister Ines. Matt's mouth dropped open. It was Maria's mother. He recognized her from the portrait, although she was older than he'd expected.
Stand up, all of you,
ordered Doña Esperanza. Carlos, Jorge, the 2 sisters, Fidelito, and Matt all struggled to their feet. Even Tonton tried to sit up straight.
I want an explanation for this, said Esperanza.
Then everyone tried to talk at once, and she crisply told them to shut up until she called on them. She looked at each person in the room, her eyes softening only when she saw Chacho.
"You," she said, pointing at Tantan. "You tell me the reason for this disgusting, unbelievable display of brutishness."
And Tantan, without a single misspoken word, told the whole story. From the time Fidelito was condemned to caning, to when Matt and Chacho were thrown into the boneyard, to when the orphans rose as an avenging army, to when Tantan drove the shrimp harvester, to when he and Chacho were finally airlifted to the hospital. Esperanza had scared the stuttering right out of him. When Tantan was finished, no one said a word. The silence stretched on and on. Matt wanted to back up Tantan's story, but one look at those fierce black eyes told him it was better to stay quiet.
"Please forgive me for putting forth my opinion, Doña Esperanza," Jorge said at last. "I must explain that this boy is mentally retarded. I rescued him from the farm patrol years ago, but he's never shown any intelligence."
"He sounds intelligent to me," said Esperanza.
"He parrots anything anyone tells him most of the time. He can hardly string a sentence together."
"I can't so," muttered Tantan.
Esperanza silenced him with a frown. She turned again to Jorge.
"Are you saying the canings never happened?"
"Of course they didn't," said the keeper. "We may keep a boy on short rations for a day if he misbehaves, but we never use physical punishment. It's against everything the keepers believe in."
"I see," said Esperanza. "And the boneyard is a myth, too."
"You know how it is," Jorge said smoothly. "Boys like to scare one another with stories after dark. They talk about vampires and the chupacabras. It's natural, but sometimes it gets out of hand."
Matt's heart sank. Esperanza nodded her head as if she agreed with Jorge. Boys did tell one another scary stories. They did make things up. But then she said,
"The warehouse full of laudanum is also a myth, I suppose?"
Jorge flinched.
"Laudanum?"
"The Aztlan police have wondered for a long time how drugs were being distributed in this country. They were extremely interested in what they found at the salt works."
"That's a vicious lie. Someone's trying to undermine the reputation of the keepers," said Carlos. "Rumors like that are spread by idiots who want orphans to lie around like pampered house cats. We know they're squalid little parasites until they're re-educated into good citizens. If any laudanum was found, it was planted there by the police."
"Fine. Then you won't mind taking a drug test," said Esperanza.
She stepped aside, and suddenly the doorway swarmed with men in blue uniforms. They must have been waiting just out of sight. Jorge and Carlos looked stunned as they were led away.
"I've been waiting for this a long time," said Esperanza, dusting off her hands as though she'd just finished a chore. "We knew the keepers were trafficking drugs, but we had no legal way to get a search warrant until Tantan told us what he saw at the keeper's compound."
She borrowed scissors from Sister Ines and began snipping off the duct tape binding the boy.
Nobody ever listened to me before, said Tantan.
"You had no one you could tell about the dreadful way you were treated," said Sister Ines. "Imagine leaving on plankton all those years. We use it only for animal feed."
Matt was dazed by the rapid change in his fortunes. Things had been going wrong for so long, it was hard to believe they might go right at last.
"Can we stay with Chacho?"
Fidelito asked shyly.
"We'll work something out," said Sister Ines. "To begin with, I'm sure you'd like a bath."
The women laughed, and Esperanza looked almost friendly. They were interrupted by a shriek. A girl in a white party dress streaked through the door and threw herself into Matt's arms.
"Oh, mother! Oh, mother! It's Matt! He's alive! He's here!"
"Good heavens, Maria," said Esperanza. "We'll never get the smell of shrimp out of that dress if you don't show a little restraint."
Chapter 37 Homecoming. Matt reveled in the clean white sheets, the soft pillows, the flower-scented air drifting in from the garden. Sister Inés had ordered him to bed after looking at the sores on his body. Fidelito and Tonton were housed at a boarding school run by the convent, but they visited Matt and Chacho every day. Poor Chacho, thought Matt. He barely noticed when anyone visited him. He drifted in and out of dreams, sometimes calling for his father, and sometimes raving about bats. Sister Inés said his mind needed time to recover from his terrible ordeal. He had breathed far less than was good for him under the heavy whale bones. His body had been starved of oxygen, and the pressure had cracked several of his ribs. The best part of the day for Matt was when Maria visited. He was content to listen, while she never ran out of things to say. She talked about stray cats she had rescued, or how she had made a mistake and put salt into a cake batter instead of sugar. Maria's life was full of drama. A flower opening in the garden and a butterfly lighting on a window were causes for excitement. Through her eyes, Matt saw the world as an infinitely hopeful place. Now Matt watched the door eagerly because he heard Maria's voice in the hall, but he was disappointed to see both her and her mother. Esperanza was dressed in steel gray. She reminded Matt of one of the guided missiles El Patrón used to get for his birthday.
I brought you some guavas, said Maria, placing a basket on the bedside table. Sister Inés says they're full of vitamin C. She says you need them to clear up your skin condition.
Matt winced. He knew his acne was horrible. Sister Inés said it was caused by pollution in the water the keepers used to grow plankton.
You look healthy, said Esperanza.
Thank you, Matt said. He didn't trust her.
Healthy enough to get up.
Oh, Mother, he needs at least another week in bed, said Maria.
You will not turn this young man into one of your invalids, Esperanza told her daughter. I've had quite enough of three-legged cats and fish that float upside down. Matt is young and resilient, and he has a very important job to do.
Uh-oh, Matt thought. What was Esperanza up to now?
We are terribly worried, Maria admitted.
We are more than worried, Esperanza said in her relentless way. Something has gone wrong in opium. Not that anything was ever right in that godforsaken wasteland. But El Patrón at least had ties with the outside world. No one has heard a word from there since the day he died.
Emilia is still in opium, Maria explained. And so is Dada. I'm still angry at them for how they treated you, but I don't want anything bad to happen to them.
Her eyes filled with tears. Esperanza made an exasperated sound.
It wouldn't bother me a bit if something happened to your Dada. Oh, do stop brimming over like a fountain, Maria. It's a silly habit and it clouds your wits. Your father is an evil man.
I can't help it, Maria sniffled.
Matt handed her one of his tissues. He privately agreed with Esperanza, but his heart was on Maria's side.
Opium is in a state of lockdown, said Esperanza. I can think of only three times that's happened in the past 100 years. It means that nothing is allowed to enter or leave the country.
Can't we just wait until they decide to contact us? Said Matt.
The other lockdowns lasted a few hours. This one's gone on for 3 months.
Matt realized what this meant. Shipments of opium had to go out every day to keep money moving around the empire. Dealers in Africa, Asia, and Europe must be clamoring for their supplies. McGregor and the other farmers couldn't cover the shortfall. They had put most of their land to crops that produce cocaine and hashish. What am I supposed to do about it? Matt said. Esperanza smiled, and he knew he'd walked into a trap.
All incoming hovercrafts have to be cleared by the security system, she said. The pilot places his hand on an identity plate in the cockpit. His fingerprints and DNA signature are beamed to the ground. If these are cleared, the ship is allowed to land. If not...
It's blown out of the sky, said Maria. Mother, this plan is awful.
During a lockdown, Esperanza went on, ignoring her daughter, no ships are cleared, with one exception. El Patrón's signature overrides everything.
Matt understood at once. His fingerprints and DNA were the same as El Patrón's. How do you know the system hasn't been changed?
I don't, said Esperanza. I'm counting on the Alacrans to have forgotten about the override. They must be in some kind of trouble, or they wouldn't have sealed themselves off.
What kind of trouble, Matt thought. Could the Egypts have revolted? Or could the farm patrol have taken over? Perhaps Mr. Alacran was locked in a power struggle with Stephen and Benito.
The way I see it, he said, I'll get blown out of the sky. If I do manage to survive, the Alacrans will have me put to sleep like an old dog. I'm a clone, in case you've forgotten. I'm livestock.
Maria flinched. Matt didn't care. Let her understand what they were asking of him. He didn't care whether Emilia and her Dada were safe. But then he heard Maria choke back a sob.
Oh, very well, he said angrily. I'm no good for spare parts anymore. You might as well throw me away on this.
I don't want to throw you away, Maria said, weeping.
Let's all take a deep breath and start over, said Esperanza. First of all, Matt, you aren't a clone.
Matt was so startled he sat straight up in bed.
Oh, you were a clone. There is no mistake about that. But we are talking about international law now.
Esperanza started pacing around the room as though she were lecturing a class.
International law is my specialty. In the first place, clones shouldn't exist.
Fat lot of good that does me, said Matt.
But if they do exist, they're livestock, as you say. That makes it possible for them to be slaughtered like chickens or cattle.
Maria moaned and put her head down on the bed.
You can't have two versions of the same person at the same time, Esperanza went on. One of them, the copy, has to be declared an unperson. But when the original dies, the copy takes his place.
What does that mean? Matt said.
It means you really are El Patron. You have his body and his identity. You own everything he owned and rule everything he ruled. It means you're the new master of opium.
Maria raised her head.
Matt's human?
He always was, her mother replied. The law is a wicked fiction to make it possible to use clones for transplants. But, bad law or not, we're going to use it now. If you survive the landing, Matt, I will do everything in my power to make you the new reigning drug lord. I have the backing of the Aztlan and U.S. governments on this. Only, you must promise me that once you are in control, you'll destroy the opium empire and tear down the barrier that has kept Aztlan and the United States apart for so long.
Matt stared at the small, fierce woman as he tried to understand the sudden shift in his fortunes. He guessed that Esperanza cared less about her daughters than her desire to destroy opium. She'd gone off without a backward glance when Maria was only 5. In all the years since, she'd never contacted her. It was only when Maria made the first move that Esperanza returned and proceeded to order everyone around. Matt thought she would easily sacrifice him to realize her goal. But how could he refuse after the terrible suffering El Patron had caused? He understood the full extent of it now. It wasn't only the drug addicts throughout the world, or the illegals doomed to slavery. It was their orphaned children as well. You could even say the old man was responsible for the keepers. If Matt had become El Patron, then he'd gotten the whole package. Wealth, power, and the evil that created it.
I promise, he said.
The hovercraft trembled as it was scanned by beacons from the ground. Matt glanced at the pilot. The man's face was grim.
When the red light goes on, press your right hand on the identity plate, he said. Warning, ground artillery deployed, flashed a panel over the controls.
They'll shoot first and ask questions later, thought Matt. He carried messages from the Aztlan and U.S. presidents. They wouldn't do much good if he got blown out of the sky.
There's a signal, cried the pilot.
The identity plate lit up. Matt slammed his hand down. He felt the tingling he'd noticed when he'd pressed the glowing scorpion outside the secret passage in the mansion. The red light faded, and the panel turned a welcoming green.
You did it, sir. Well done.
The pilot began to bleed off anti-gravity in preparation for landing. Matt felt a glow of happiness. The man had called him sir. Matt watched anxiously through the window.
he saw the estancia as he'd never seen it before. The water purification plant lay far to the east, and the little church Celia visited, could she still visit as an Egypt, was to the west. In between were storehouses, drug purification labs, and a factory where food pellets for the Egypts were made. Slightly to the north was the gray, featureless hospital. Even from here it looked sinister. Next to it was the mausoleum, where the Alacrans slept in their marble drawers. The swimming pool flashed with sunlight as they passed over. Matt searched the grounds for people. He saw Egypts crouching by a lawn. He saw maids hanging out wash, and someone seemed to be repairing a roof. No one looked up. No one showed the slightest interest in the hovercraft that was now descending to the ground. "Where's the welcoming committee?" he murmured. A platoon of bodyguards always ran out to greet visitors. The ship bumped gently to a landing.
"Do you need a weapon, sir?"
asked the pilot, handing him a gun. Matt looked at it with dismay. Such guns had been used by the farm patrol to stun and kill the parents of Chacho, Flaco, Tonton, and the other orphans. "It's probably better to appear friendly," he said, handing the weapon back.
"I'll remain here in liftoff mode in case you want to leave quickly," the pilot said.
Matt opened the door and climbed down. The landing field was empty. The only sounds were of birds, fountains, and, briefly, the hammer of the man fixing the roof. Matt followed a winding path through the gardens. His job was to confront the Alacrans and end the lockdown. He could disable the lockdown system himself when he found it. Tamlin or Daft Donald would know its location. Then Esperanza and top officials from both countries on the border would descend on Opium and try to install Matt as leader. "I had better odds for survival in the boneyard," he thought. He saw a peacock strut across a lawn. A mob of red-winged blackbirds shrieked at one another from a crowded tree. A winged baby watched him from atop a fountain. Matt's nerves were raw. Any minute now, Mr. Alacran would stride out of the house and shout, "Take this creature away! Dispose of it at once!" Memories threatened to overwhelm him. He didn't know what he'd do if he saw Celia. Matt went up the broad steps leading to the salon. It was there that El Patron had introduced him to the family so long ago. It was there that El Viejo had lain like a starved bird in his coffin, and Emilia, surrounded by Egypt flower girls, had married Stephen. It was as though the great hall thronged with ghosts. They hovered behind the white marble pillars. They breathed over the dark pond covered with water lilies. Matt saw an ancient fish rise from the depths to look at him with a round, yellow eye. Matt froze. Someone was playing a piano. The person was certainly skilled, but he, or she, was attacking the music with such ferocity that it bordered on madness. Matt raced toward the sound. The noise rolled like a tidal wave out of the music room, and he had to cover his ears. "Stop!" he yelled, but the person didn't react. Matt crossed the room and grabbed the man's arm. Mr. Ortega spun around. He took one look and fled. Matt heard his footsteps disappear down the hall.
"I wasn't that bad a student," Matt murmured.
But of course Mr. Ortega had thought he was dead. He was probably crying alarm from one end of the house to the other. Now it was only a matter of time before someone showed up. Matt sat down. His hands were calloused from the work he'd done at the salt factory, and he was afraid the hard labor had made his fingers clumsy. But as he began the adagio from Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5, the awkwardness fell away. The music swelled through his body, transporting him from the horrors of the past few months. He felt as light as a hawk coasting the upper air over the oasis. He played until he felt a hand on his shoulder. Matt turned, still in a daze of music, and saw Celia dressed in the flowered dress he remembered so well.
"Mijo," she cried, gathering him into a ferocious bear hug. "Oh, my darling, you're so thin. What happened to you in all this time? How did you get back? What's wrong with your face? It's so thin and
covered with zits," said Matt, struggling to catch his breath.
"Ah, well, it's part of growing up," declared Celia. "They'll go away with the right food."
She held him at arm's length to look at him.
"I'm sure you're taller."
"Are you okay?" said Matt. Her sudden appearance shocked him.
He was afraid of bursting into tears.
Of course.
But you took about 5 years off Mr. Ortega's life.
How did you... I mean, Tamlin said you had to hide.
Matt couldn't trust his voice enough to say any more.
Tamlin.
Oh, my. Celia suddenly looked very tired.
We've been in lockdown for months and couldn't send out a message.
Why didn't Mr. Alacrán or Stephen do something? Said Matt.
You'd better come with me.
Celia led Matt through the halls, and once again he was struck by how silent everything was. They came to the kitchen, and at last Matt saw something reassuringly normal. Two undercooks were kneading bread, and a maid was slicing vegetables. Strings of garlic and chiles hung from the ceiling. The odor of roast chicken wafted over him from the big wood-fired oven. Mr. Ortega and Daft Donald were sitting at a table with cups of coffee and two laptop computers.
See, I wasn't making it up, said Mr. Ortega.
Daft Donald typed something onto his computer.
I was not running around like Chicken Little, said Mr. Ortega, reading his screen. You'd be upset too if a ghost grabbed your shoulder.
Daft Donald smiled. Matt stared at them. He'd never thought of the two men outside their duties as music teacher and bodyguard. He'd never tried to communicate with them. And besides, he'd always assumed Daft Donald wasn't bright.
I'd better begin, sighed Celia.
She settled Matt between the two men and fetched him a mug of hot cocoa. The odor brought back memories so profound, the room wavered before his eyes. For an instant, Matt was in the little house in the poppy fields. A storm raged outside, but in the house it was warm and safe. Then the scene faded, and he was back in the kitchen.
You remember what I said about El Patrón never letting anything go? Celia began. Matt nodded. Tamlin used to say that things, and people, became part of El Patrón's dragon horde.
Used to say, Matt thought with a chill. What did that mean?
That's why he wouldn't let Felicia run away, and why he kept Tom close to him, although he hated the boy. We all belong to him. The Alacráns, the bodyguards, the doctors, me, Tamlin, and you. Most of all, you.
Chapter 38. The House of Eternity. Matt saw that last evening in his mind's eye as Celia and the others told the story. When she faltered, Daft Donald would take up the narrative on his computer. Sometimes, Mr. Ortega would burst in with an opinion. While he, Matt, was lying under the stars at the oasis, Tamlin and everyone else had been called to the wake. Celia was missing because she was supposed to be in Egypt. Mr. Ortega was missing because he hadn't heard about it. Besides, he'd lived such a quiet existence for so many years that everyone had forgotten about him. The farm patrol stood at attention in the gathering dusk. Six bodyguards, including Tamlin and Daft Donald, carried the coffin from the hospital to the desert beyond the mausoleum. One man alone could have carried El Patrón, but the coffin was so encrusted with gold that six could barely lift it. They walked slowly as a choir of Egypt children sang the humming chorus from the opera Madama Butterfly. It was one of El Patrón's favorite pieces, and the Egypt's voices were high and sweet.
I heard it from the stables, said Celia, wiping her eyes. He was an evil man, but the music would have broken your heart.
A door had been opened in the ground. A ramp led down into a vast underground chamber lit by candles. It was only the first of many chambers leading off under the earth. Daft Donald said he didn't know how many there were. The coffin was a wonder, Daft Donald wrote on his computer. It had an image of El Patrón on the lid, like the portrait of an Egyptian pharaoh. El Patrón looked about 25. You couldn't recognize him except, and here Daft Donald glanced up, that he looked a great deal like Matt. Matt felt cold. Everyone went down into the chamber, the bodyguard continued typing, which was filled with drifts of gold coins. You had to wade through them like sand on a beach. Daft Donald saw some of the bodyguards scoop some up and hide them in their pockets. The priest performed the funeral rites. Then the Egypts and Farm Patrol were sent away. It was time for the wake.
Which is just another name for a party,
interrupted Mr. Ortega.
You celebrate the dead man's life, or in this case, his 8 lives. You were supposed to be the 9th, Matt.
Matt felt even colder. Everyone was in a fine mood, but with the food and wine, wrote Daft Donald. Everyone talked about what an old beast El Patron was, and how they were glad he was dead. It had gone on for hours, when Tamlin brought out a special wine that had been bottled the year El Patron was born. It was in a musty crate, covered with cobwebs and sealed with the Alacrán scorpion mark.
This is what El Patron was saving for his 150th birthday, announced Mr. Alacrán. If he didn't make it, it was supposed to be served at his funeral. I propose we drink it to celebrate the old buzzard's death.
Hear, hear, everyone cried.
Stephen opened the first bottle and sniffed it.
It smells like someone opened a window in heaven, he said. Then it doesn't belong with this crowd, Tom yelled.
Everyone roared with laughter. They passed around fine crystal glasses. Mr. Alacrán said they were all supposed to toast El Patrón at the same time and then smash their glasses on his coffin. I had a glass, wrote Daft Donald, but Tamlin came up to me and said, don't drink it, laddie. I've got a strange feeling about this wine. And so I didn't. We raised our glasses for the toast. Mr. Alacrán said,
tomorrow we'll send a truck down here and haul this stuff away. Here's to greed.
Everyone cheered and then they drank. Except for me. Before the next minute had passed, they had all fallen to the ground. Just like that. As though someone had reached inside and turned off a switch.
What happened? Matt asked, gasping.
I went from one person to the next trying to wake them up, but they were all dead, wrote Daft Donald.
Dead,
cried Matt.
I'm so terribly, terribly sorry,
said Celia.
Not Tamlin. The poison was very quick. I don't think he felt it.
But he knew something was wrong with the wine, shouted Matt. Why did he drink it?
Listen to me, said Celia.
El Patrón had ruled his empire for 100 years. All that time he was adding to his dragon hoard, and he wanted to be buried with it. Unfortunately, Celia stopped and wiped her eyes. Unfortunately, the dragon hoard included people. Matt remembered with a chill how often the old man had spoken of the Chaldean kings. Not only were they buried with clothes and food, but their horses were slaughtered to provide transport in the shadowy world of the dead. In one tomb, archaeologists had discovered soldiers, servants, and even dancing girls laid out as though they were sleeping. One girl had been in such a hurry, the blue ribbon she was meant to wear in her hair was still rolled up in her pocket. The plan must have been in El Patrón's mind all along. He'd never intended to let Mr. Alacrán or Stephen inherit his kingdom. Their education was as hollow as Matt's. None of them was meant to survive.
Tamlin knew what was going to happen, said Celia. El Patrón told him everything. He was closer to the old man than anyone, except, perhaps, you.
I laid out the bodies, wrote Daft Donald, as many as I could manage. I was crying. I don't mind admitting it. It happened so fast. It was so awful. I went outside and got dynamite from a storage shed. I wired it to the entrance passage and set it off.
I didn't hear the explosion, but I felt it, said Mr. Ortega.
Everyone ran out to see what had happened, said Celia. We found the passageway buried, and Donald lying stunned on the ground.
I felt the explosion too, Matt murmured. Just before dawn, the ground trembled, and it woke me up.
Tamlin saw it as his chance to free the Egypts, said Celia. That's why he didn't warn anyone except Donald about the wine. I know it sounds terrible, but how else was he to break the power of the Alacráns? El Patrón had ruled this country for 100 years. His children might rule for another 100.
Matt could see the buried tomb in his mind's eye.
The broken wine glasses. El Patrón's portrait staring up from the coffin. The bodyguards laid out in their dark suits. Only instead of ribbons, they had gold coins in their pockets. Tom was there too. his lying, oh-so-believable voice stilled forever. How many times had Matt entertained himself with thoughts of Tom's downfall? Now that it had happened, Matt felt numb. Tom had been no more in charge of his fate than the dullest Egypt.
Tamlin did what he wanted to do, Celia said. He was guilty of a terrible crime when he was young, and he could never forgive himself for it. He believed this last act would make up for everything.
Well, it didn't, shouted Matt. He was an idiot. A stupid, crotting idiot. He jumped up. Mr. Ortega tried to stop him, but Celia shook her head. Matt ran through the gardens until he came to the stables. Get me a horse, he yelled. After a moment, Rosa shuffled out.
A safe horse, master, she said.
For a moment, Matt was tempted to ask for Tamlin's steed, but he wasn't skilled enough to ride it. A safe horse, he said. Soon, he was moving through the fields, as he had done so many times before. Some were misted with the bitter green of opium seedlings. Some dazzled his eyes with the glory of full-grown poppies. A faint, corrupt perfume hung in the air. Matt saw the first laborers. They walked slowly, bending down with tiny knives to slash the seed pods. What was he going to do about them? He was their lord now. He was the master of this vast army. Matt felt utterly drained. Somehow, he'd expected everything to work out. He'd expected himself, Maria, Tamlin, and Celia to someday be happy together. Now, it was all ruined. You fool, he shouted at the vanished Tamlin. Could the Egypt operation be reversed? Even with a restaffed hospital, it might take years. That is, if Matt could lure doctors to opium after they found out what had happened to the last batch. He'd have to get rid of the farm patrol. They were felons wanted in countries all over the world. He could tell their police forces to come and get them. He would have to hire other, less violent men to replace them because the Egypts couldn't exist without orders. It was an overwhelming problem. He'd need to hire another army of bodyguards. Wealth such as opium possessed lured criminals. Always choose your bodyguards from another country, whispered El Patron. They find it harder to make alliances and betray you. Okay, thought Matt. He would ask Daft Donald about it tomorrow. A pack of Scottish soccer louts sounded about right. He gave the horse a drink and made his way into the mountains. A clear blue sky cast its light over the oasis. The sand next to the water was marked with animal prints, and the metal chest was still hidden under the grape arbor. Matt rummaged through it until he found Tamlin's old note. Dear Matt, he read. I'm a lousy writer, so this won't be long. El Patron says I have to go with him. I can't do anything about it. I put supplies in this chest plus books. You never know when you might need things. Your friend, Tamlin. Matt folded it and put it into his pocket, along with a flashlight for when it got dark. He made a fire and warmed his hands as he listened to the sounds of the oasis. It was too cold to swim. He would dig up the poppy fields and put in normal crops. Once the Egypts were cured, Matt would give them the choice of returning home or of working for him. He would help them find their children. Matt sat up straight. Of course, Chacho, Fidelito, and Tonton. He could invite them to live with him. He could imagine Fidelito's wide-eyed astonishment. This is really yours, the little boy would cry. You're not making it up. It's all right, Chacho would say, refusing to be impressed. Matt could give him his old guitar. Mr. Ortega could teach him music. Tonton could have his own machine shop. He could maintain the equipment Matt needed to create his new farms. He could invite Maria to stay and hope that Esperanza was busy somewhere else. Maria would love reuniting the Egypts with their children. And they could have picnics and ride horses. And she could keep as many three-legged cats as she liked. Matt looked up at the sky. Sunset wasn't far off. The light was turning gold, and sunlight shone through a gap in the mountains and made a bar of radiance on a wall of rock just beyond the oasis. Matt saw something dazzle. He jumped up and ran to the spot before the radiance slipped behind the mountains. When he arrived, shadow had almost hidden the mark, but he saw it in the red light of the setting sun, a shining scorpion. He pressed his hand against it. Slowly, silently, a door opened in the cliff. Matt felt the rock. It wasn't stone after all, but a clever imitation. The door revealed a dark passage going down into the earth. Matt shone the flashlight inside. The floor glittered with gold coins. Farther on were weird statues that might have been Egyptian gods. Matt lay back against the cliff, breathing hard. It was part of a Badrong's dragon horde. It was the first of the underground chambers that stretched all the way to El Patron's coffin and his attendants. Around the old man were bodyguards to protect him in the shadowy world of the dead. There were doctors to attend to his health. Mr. Alacran could entertain him with matters of business, and Stephen could offer opinions about the farming of poppies. There would certainly be an opium farm in El Patron's version of heaven. Felicia, Fanny, and Emilia could admire him from tables covered with moro crabs and caramel puddings. And Tamlin? Matt took out the note again. El Patron says I have to go with him. I can't do anything about it. You could have done something about it, Matt whispered. You could have said no. He stepped away, and the door slid shut again. He ran his fingers over the surface. He couldn't tell where the opening had been, but he could find it again with red light. Late that night, Matt sat by the fire and smelled the good mesquite smoke as it spiraled up into the starry sky. Tomorrow, he would begin the task of breaking down the Empire of Opium. It was a huge and terrifying job, but he wasn't alone. He had Chacho, Fidelito, and Tonton to cheer him on. He had Celia and Daft Donald to advise him, and Maria to be everyone's conscience. He also had Esperanza, but he couldn't see a way out of that. With everyone's help, it would get done. You can do it, said Tamlin from the darkness on the other side of the fire. I know I can, said Matt, smiling back.
The House of the Scorpion was written by Nancy Farmer and read by Raul Esparza. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. The associate producer was Travis Tun. The House of the Scorpion was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The House of the Scorpion is available in hardcover from Athenaeum Books for Young Readers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.